What's up? What's up? Welcome to another episode of All Over VoiceOver with Kiff VH. I am your host, Kiff VH, and you are in for a treat because today I'm releasing my first double album. This is Use Your Illusion 1 and 2, released simultaneously, just like Guns N' Roses back in 1991. This Guns N' Roses, however, happens to be the lovely, the talented, the hilarious Rama Valluri. Rama sat down with me earlier this week, and we talked for 3 hours. And rather than release the Snyder Cut version, I decided to split this up into two pieces in case you get lost. We talk about his voiceover career, his origins, his improv background or his improv infusion into his VO career. He's an incredibly funny, talented guy, and has a lot of really fantastic things to share from dealing with agencies, acquiring agencies, losing agents when you're killing it and then the agent closes underneath you. He addresses that as well. So there's a ton of great stuff to go through, and he's a really entertaining and fun guy. I think you're going to enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Rama Valluri, this is part one, here we go.
I'm so excited to have on the show tonight a tremendous voice actor who we've known each other around the fringes, but connected last week, and it was like, well, why don't you come on the show, for God's sake? Rama Valluri is here with us. Rama, thanks again for dropping by, dude. This is awesome to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks, Kiff. I am a fan of this show. I listen to this show, and oh, I tell students of mine to listen to this show, so it's a delight to be here.
Oh, dude, thank you so much. Well, I mean, as we got the intro out of the way, circling back to NDAs, we were just speaking before, as the music was playing, about the volume of NDAs, code words, code names, just not knowing what you're really auditioning for, and how that, how does that influence how you approach a piece of copy? Like, do you need, like, I mean, obviously, if there's something that's known, like a known property, let's say, you know, like, I'm not under this, so who knows, but like a Batman game, and there's a, you know, there's little clues of, like, you know, oh, it's called Squish Pants, and then you're like, all right, and it's like, it's, you know, Night Falls in Gotham City, and you're like, okay, I know where I am. But like, how do you navigate that? Or do you navigate and just kind of like bulldoze it?
It's really interesting. I've started to figure out to a degree how they're, or who it is that I'm reading for based on how they've given you the copy.
Huh.
If it's just, here's 5 lines with one emotion versus here is a bit of concept art that may or may not be related, but then everything is in a table, like an Excel table,
yeah,
with context in them, the lines. They're just these patterns that certain companies seem to have. So then I have a decent idea of, okay, it could be any number of these.
Yeah.
But most of the time, I think the thing that I've begun focusing on more is the age range and any specific accent information right at the beginning. Because a lot of the expository things that they give you largely are covered by those two bits of information.
Yeah.
In a world where they're prioritizing booking natural or conversational voices over the broader characters, it's,
yeah,
where do you find the truth in that, and how do you get your natural speaking voice to nest into that context so it's not trying, it's being. So I look for that bit of information, and then I see, okay, where can I ground myself in reality and then play within it, find the music in it, and play. But the code words, it's so tricky because some of them, they have similar themes to them of,
yeah,
where they originate in history or,
yeah,
or literature. And then you go, okay, is this still the same thing that maybe 8 months ago I did something for? And it was one really funny one was recently, it didn't even occur to me until I was playing the game.
Oh, wow.
I was playing Final Fantasy VII Remake because an old coworker of mine, he made a joke and I called him on it. Of, he was saying everybody should play it. And I went, will you buy it for me? And he went, only if you're serious. I'm like, yeah, I'm serious. So then he asked me my address, and I gave it to him. And then 2 months later or so, the deluxe version of the game showed up at my door.
God.
And I went, did I buy this? And I had to think about it. And he really, because I called him on the bluff, he sent it. So I'm playing this, and there's this bit where you're on motorcycles riding through the busy downtown, and it leads to this battle. And I can't even remember the name of the character, so if people like it, they're probably going to be mad at me right now. He's a showboat riding this motorcycle, and you're battling him a little bit, and he keeps coming back throughout the story. And something was oddly familiar about it. And I don't remember playing this game as a kid.
Yeah.
Maybe I watched my brother play it a little bit, but he said a line, and I hit pause on the controller, went back to my email, and typed it in, and I found it. And I went, I did audition for this. I knew it. And then when I hit start, I started listening to what that actor did.
Yeah.
Went, oh, so that's what they were going for.
Yeah.
Whether I was close or not, I went, well, good for you. But it's a completely different approach now, where any game that comes out or a lot of the different shows that pop up, I can spot it and go, oh, yeah, I remember reading for this back when.
Yeah. And it's and the lead time is like 2.5-3 years sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it's like just this distant memory. Dude, I want to circle back to some of those things that you were saying right at the top there about finding the place where you intersect with the character, and both the age, the regionalisms, the emotional life, like the you know, we're both improv guys, so like the environment and all those things too. Like, what's your I want to get into your history as well, but while we're in this space, like what's your process with using environment, for example, for a series where you get, you know, like a video game read where you get 8 different lines with different contexts and emotional stakes, where they've given you one playable action where it's like, okay, you're confused or you're confident or whatever. And then like, how do you address that line? Is character first, or is environment, is circumstance? Like, what's your approach to those, to something like that, to this hypothetical piece of copy?
Usually I start from something physical, where when I'm figuring out what the character sounds like at the beginning and I'm trying to find what that would sound like, what that would feel like, I give myself imaginary physical weights, whether this person might be taller than me or shorter than me, broader than me, heavier, lighter. Is there some characteristic that they gave me that can inform it? And I try to find that physical place. There was a show that I once auditioned for where the character art that they gave was just this very round anthropomorphic creature, but was the sidekick to the lead. And the lead was one of those Bart Simpson type overly confident pranksters. So yeah, this is one of those Milhouse type sidekick roles.
Yeah.
But looking at that character, all I could think of was the only thing they were secure in was how physically secure they were.
Wow.
That they had this presence that you can't physically knock them down, but emotionally you could right away. And
yes.
So I thought about that and I just put my arms out. I felt like, okay, here's 360 degrees of what it feels like to move like this character. And then went, okay, so if I ground myself and I plant myself in place and I feel this, everything else becomes very cerebral. So no matter what it was that I was saying, everything was twinged with doubt and fear. And
that's so awesome.
Went, great. So now we play musically over it, where it isn't just delivering the line, it's every bit of it. Okay, this isn't a line that a character is saying. This is a truth that I am speaking because I am this character now. So, you know, trying to figure out what it is you're going to say, but sometimes it just sort of gets away from you. Sometimes it speeds up and then slows down. There's just little pauses. Where that's the nice thing about the audition, you have the freedom to really, really play.
Yeah.
Because once you're getting directed, then all the considerations of, well, we have an animatic or we don't have an animatic, or this is how much we're letting you play within the space, knowing that right. we do have to go back and animate.
Right.
But you can always give more and pull back. It's much harder to restrain yourself totally and then get the note, can you go bigger?
Yeah.
Because that limit is so much higher now. You're like, well, how big is too big?
Right.
If everything you started off is way down here and everything's very constrained and they go, let's do something completely different, now you're going by degrees. Is it
right.
three notes higher? Is it 5 words per second? How fast are you speaking?
Yeah.
You can get very in your head on that. But if you give yourself that physical reality, it's an easy reminder that even if you lose the voice for a minute, there's a secure place that you can get back to. And it's yeah. much like doing improv, where if I'm on stage, I see everything in chalk lines.
Yeah.
So I go out there with nothing, but the moment we get a suggestion or we start building something together, it starts drawing itself in,
yeah.
almost in that a beautiful mind kind of graphic thing. Okay, so here's the table here, there's a window here and all this. So
yeah.
when people go walking through tables, I immediately get horrified. Like, ah!
Yeah. Are you a ghost?
Are you all right? How's your knee? But that's a great thing because it's written in that invisible chalk that only I'm seeing, or if you're yeah. really lucky and you're that connected with who you're playing with,
yeah,
all of it can shift in a second, where you might think you're in a shack in the Old West and then someone says something and suddenly you're in a high rise in Hong Kong. You're like, okay.
Bim. Yep.
Right. We just lifted this up about 1,000 feet and...
right.
Right.
It doesn't change the location of the sink. It just means that it's colder. It's a nice yeah. sink. It's a higher quality stainless
yeah,
steel.
It's not a bucket and a pump. There's actual plumbing. There's a view now.
Right.
So it's the little changes like that.
I can still smoke in both environments. I'm comfortable with my object yeah. work cigarettes.
So just notice like, oh, it was sunrise. We didn't have one of those before.
That's right. Well, that's fascinating. Let me back up. Tell where are you from? Where did you grow up?
I'm from Chicago. I was born in Chicago. Grew up in the suburbs, southwest suburbs in Burr Ridge. Off of I-55, the Stevenson Expressway, for those playing at home.
Yes.
But yeah, I was born in Chicago. We lived around the city and then out in the suburbs. And my mom told me the first voice that I ever did. I was 3 and did an impression of Daffy Duck leaving a family. We were leaving a family friend's house, like one of these very Indian parties of all the South Indian families. And it happened to be the... some relatives who were like best friends with my grandfather, and as we're walking out, I turned around when my aunt said bye, and I went, "Thanks for the hospitality." And for some reason, everybody forgot. Like the line outlived what the voice was, so for years nobody knew. They kept saying, "Well, I don't know where this kid got it. Why is he saying that? Why did he say it like that?" And it was this big joke. My cousin, who wasn't born like 16 years later, like after me, she hears the story and she goes, "That's just Daffy Duck. He was doing Daffy Duck." And then everyone, "Oh my God, that was what he was doing." So the nice thing is I come from a family of jokers and storytellers, especially on my dad's side. He's the great unknown comedian of his generation, and I've stolen all of his moves.
Amazing.
Which is nice, but then I have 2 older brothers and a joke playing father. So you had to make the joke about yourself before somebody else made it about you.
Yeah,
because that way you take the power out of the joke.
That's
Otherwise,
right.
if they say it before you, suddenly things can get real personal. And go, ah, no.
That's
and as the youngest one. You really have to listen as much as you can because
yeah.
there's. Your dad, who there's a certain line you can't cross with the jokes.
Right, right.
And there's your oldest brother who, by default, you always look at the oldest sibling as, okay, they're the coolest person
yeah.
that you know. And then my brother, 2 years older than me. So he and I had a 2-year difference. He and my oldest brother have a 3-year difference. So it was this interesting point where if those two started arguing, I'm somewhere in the middle of I have a lot in common with my oldest brother because we're both sports junkies and we listen to a lot of the same music. But I'm also in that range with my brother 2 years older than me in a lot of the kind of movies that we watch, like 80s action movies are a huge, huge hit.
Awesome.
So you'd have to pick up on whatever you could, because if they stopped fighting with each other and turned back on you, you're like, wait, now it's that's double barrel coming at you.
And they're warmed up. They've got
much, much frothing. That's the thing I remember as a kid. I spent a lot of time watching my brothers playing video games, where they were really good at it, and I was more invested in what the story was because I just wanted to see where it would go, and I knew that I was gonna fall behind. And they would let me play a lot, but it was that Luigi kind of syndrome. Like, well, Mario's the lead, you get to be Luigi, or you get to be Tails in Sonic.
Right.
You're always the second character and the one who, if the screen moves too fast, if
you die.
They die, it doesn't matter. They come back.
Yeah, you just regenerate.
Like, there's no risk to you playing at that point, but you could help by getting more coins or rings or something.
Exactly.
So that sort of instinct kicked in, and then really close with all my cousins, where they were all basically brothers and sisters. So you learn to play very early, but I didn't actually start doing any of this in a public way until I got to college.
Really?
I went in as a declared history major. I was going to be a history professor, and I very nearly was.
Wow.
But around 2007, the professor who I was studying the most under, John Lynn at the University of Illinois, was doing a study abroad in Paris over the summer of 2007, a military and art history study abroad in Paris. And I thought, well, if I'm going to go on a study abroad, I should go with this guy because that sounds really cool.
Yeah.
And both from a class standpoint and getting to go to Paris, and my oldest brother had been mad at me because the year before I didn't apply to go to one in Greece, partly because it was financial, and the other was like, I probably shouldn't. And he, as someone older and who had done a bunch of study abroads and things, was like, you're wasting the best possibility that you get when you're in college.
Wow.
So I went, and while I was on there, one of the other students I was with, she was a music director at the radio station. And my brother was a legend at that station and had a job waiting for me the day I stepped on the campus of the University of Illinois.
Oh my God.
And I didn't take it because I knew I had to focus on getting my grades in the first little while, and I didn't want to get my parents upset that I was losing focus. Then I go to Paris and I'm hanging out with all them, and she says, okay, you should come to this info night and all this. And I went, well, my brother told me to go, and well, now you made it sound real fun. Let's go. Next thing I knew, I was a on-air DJ, and I was working in the production department. So I was writing, voicing, editing, producing commercials.
Just like that.
And just like that. And then the next thing I knew, I was hosting 9 shows on air, and I was running the production department and had people working under me.
Oh, my God. What year in school were you at this point? Were you like a junior?
I was a junior when I walked in.
Amazing.
So in those 2 years, I went and did everything you could in that, and even went to a radio conference in Chicago, the Conclave. And because I had a couple hours off, I went and took the GRE in between. Like, oh, here's some panels with these Chicago radio legends and things, and doing air checks with the professionals. Like, oh, well, I should take the GRE while I'm doing this. So I went and did that, and then went back.
Oh my God.
And one of the production directors who listened to the tape that I had told me, if I were you, I would just leave school right now, and you could be doing this at a station. I was like, well, are you offering me a job right now? Because if you are, that's something to talk about. He said, well, I don't have one open right now, but I could down the road. I was like, well, if you don't have a job for me, then I'm not going to leave school
right
before I'm going to graduate anyway. But that put something in my head.
Wow.
And once, like, I graduated in 2009, so 2008, the economy completely collapsed.
That's
all of a sudden, you go, well, the market for someone with a honors degree in English and an English literature degree doesn't look great.
Oh, man.
If you're trying not to go straight to get that PhD, which I was going to, until my grandmother said to me, of all people, why do you want to do this? you know how hard it is, because I come from a family of academics. My grandfather was a professor of organic chemistry.
Wow.
And my mom was a professor of anatomy and physiology. I had aunts who were teaching chemistry. My mom ended up, when I was seven, she went back to med school and became a doctor.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, my grandmother just looked at it and went, well, you know how hard it is to be a professor. You know how little money you make. You know how you grew up seeing this. Why do you want to do this to yourself? And I said to her, it's the only thing I know that I'm really good at.
Hmm.
And she went, well, what about advertising? You work at the radio station. And I went, well, that's true. So I thought, okay, you know what? There's nothing lost here. I can gamble a year of my life and see.
Right.
So instead of applying directly into history programs, where I'd been thinking, I'm going to go to the University of Chicago. It's a six-year master's PhD program. I'll live in England and India and continue research, learn four languages. Still sounds like a great idea.
It sounds very attractive.
But off of that GRE I took when I was at that conference, I applied into a bunch of different ad programs, including the one at Illinois, which was number one.
Wow.
But then I got this letter and a series of emails from Syracuse going, well, based on your scores and what you did, you should consider applying to Newhouse in one of our programs. And I saw on one of them, it's like, oh, you get a one-year master's in TV, radio, and film. Yeah, okay, I'll apply there as a lark. And then I got in, and I really had to think about it because the head of the department called me and offered me a TA position, which automatically wiped out half of your tuition at Syracuse.
Yeah.
And he was talking to me, he's like, well, the grades are one thing, but you work in this. You're already working in radio and you're doing all this. And he never tried to hard sell me once, but we had five separate hour-long conversations.
Oh, my God.
Where he would just call me just to see how I was doing and see, can I answer any questions for you? Because he knew, as someone who was born in Chicago, grew up in the suburbs, went to the University of Illinois, I'm as Illinois as you can get.
Yeah.
So to convince someone like me to go to upstate New York or central New York is weather might not be that different, but culturally it's a completely different thing.
Yeah.
And what really sold me on going was he said, look, any permutation of orange and blue you choose is going to be a great one. All I can say is every time I get a paycheck, I feel guilty depositing it because I love what I do so much.
Wow.
And because he said that, I want that.
Yeah,
I just want that feeling. I don't know what it's ultimately going to be, but I want that.
Yeah.
So I went and thought, okay, well, look, if I don't like it or anything, at 23, I'll have a master's and I can go right back into history. It's not going to be that big of a delay.
Right.
But I kept finding reasons. Like 2 weeks later, after graduating, one of my best friends went, okay, we're driving. We're going to L.A. Like he had decided it for me. He's like, well, we don't go to New York. The older guys are going to go to New York. We're going to L.A. I went, fair enough. And my parents had to move, so they sold the house in Chicago while I was still in grad school, and I didn't even get to go back when it was happening. So I went, well, I'm a man without a home, so I really could go anywhere.
That's right.
So I just stayed at my grandmother's house for 2 weeks. Then he drove from Syracuse to Chicago. I jumped in his car. We loaded stuff into mine, shipped my car, and then he and I drove across the rest of the country in 3 days.
Amazing.
In one of the most insane experiences ever. If you've seen the movie With Nail and I, when they're driving back from the country to London, that was our entire drive.
That's incredible.
So, yeah, and then we came here. We really had nothing. We had no internships. We had no job opportunities. We had no prospects. We were just two guys who showed up. And
off of that, just to jump in on this, so your degree, your master's degree, is in specifically in broadcasting, or was it more of a generic sort of in the broadcast arts sort of a thing where you could do broadcast, you could do radio, you could do TV, you learned enough to be dangerous?
Well, the degree is in television, radio, and film.
Okay.
Or as they say at the SI Newhouse School, TRF.
Okay.
So within that, it covers if you wanted to specialize in whatever you happen to be specializing in. When I showed up, they asked me, like, what do you want to do? And because I came from an audio background and I was voicing things and editing things, I was always attracted to that. So I was like, well, audio is a big thing, but I'm a writer, and I'd been a writer my whole life.
Yeah.
So he said, great. The only thing I'm ever going to ask you to do is write and make noises. I went, okay. So I got to determine the classes I took off of that. And my advisor was Doug Quinn, who worked with Werner Herzog on
Encounters
at the End of the World. So
oh.
learning of how to do Foley and field recording from him was incredible.
Wow.
And some of the people I learned from, the biggest influence on me there was a man named Richard Dubin, who I'm still in close contact with. This man has done everything from playing in big bands with Otis Redding to being a top executive at CBS and flying their private plane.
Oh, my
Frank's
God.
Frank's Place was a big thing that he worked on.
Oh, my God. That was probably my favorite show.
It's ever. So great. And I only got to see it because I was in his class. And
wow.
He played it for us. But he was one of those people who, when I walked in, he came right over to me. And we just started talking about violin jazz. He just went, so what kind of music do you listen to? And we were talking about it. And somehow I mentioned Django Reinhardt. And he goes, Reinhardt, love him. Good guy. Three fingers. Have you listened to Grappelli? It's like, well, he plays with him. He's like, but have you gone further? And then he starts naming all of these different jazz violins, like Joe Venuti. And I remember when he said Stuff Smith, I spent the next several years, because I collect vinyl, looking for this one Stuff Smith record called Blues in the Dungeon, which was a duet album he did with Stefan Grappelli. And I found it for a buck.
Amazing.
Randomly at a bookstore. I was like, you don't know what you have. So he and I connected on music right away. And then he just would pop in and see me at some point and go, I have a book for you. You need to read this, especially for where you're at in your life. And I went, what is it? And he hands me a copy of Be Here Now. He says, you need to read this. Ram Dass is spelled a little bit differently from you. A lot of the things in it are going to be familiar. But I think what you need to pay attention to is the moment.
Like,
wow. You really need, it was the title. He was like, you need to be present, because you're, he could see that I was constantly working on the next thing while working on the thing.
Yes.
And
totally
he went, basically looked at me and goes, you need to give yourself the liberation of just existing.
Wow.
And not persisting constantly. He's like, you need to actually just look around and go, hey, this is pretty neat.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah. So it's just a crazy confluence of events. And part of the thing, too, when I came out, when I was in grad school, they went, okay, you can go on this 1 week trip. You either go to LA or you go to New York and you get an idea of what the industry is like. They take you to meet folks. And on that trip that we came out here, the professor, Tom Seeley, he wrote on Murphy Brown. He's got an Emmy. Great guy. He thought it would be neat to have us go to a voice casting agency just to see what it was like. And it was Elaine Craig.
Oh, my God.
And same office that she's in today. And we go up there, and she's giving us this tour. And she asks, has anyone ever thought about working in VO? And I'm that guy. My grad project for the audio class at Syracuse was stripping 10 minutes of audio out of Who Framed Roger Rabbit with two friends of mine. And then we had to rebuild everything. Do
incredible.
All the voices, play all the music, do all the Foley, all the sound effects and everything.
Brilliant.
So I go, yeah, that's me. Also, I'd worked in this. So she puts people in the booth, just three at a time, because it was a group read, and I will never forget it. It was Washington Post magazine. It was in a dentist's office. It was a man named Gewurztraminer trying to scam the office because he just wants to read that magazine.
Right.
So it was two friends of mine and me. And I don't know why in the middle of this trip, I thought, hey, this is a real good time to flex this. And we hit the post both times, exactly 30 seconds, both times. So when she pulls us out of the booth and they start leading everybody, oh, now let's go this way. She pulls me aside. She goes, have you ever thought about working in voiceover? Like, every day of my life, except you can't just open up a newspaper and go to the classifieds and apply
right.
for this. Because you could still do that 11 years ago.
Man.
And she went, are you moving here? I said, yes, in June. He goes, okay, when you move here, when you get here, you call me, you tell me, and I'm going to put you in touch with the one coach you need to work with, because you should be doing this.
Wow.
Like, whoa. It was like, that was the coolest thing that happened to me, the most important connection I made on that trip. And when we moved out, I tried to get a hold of her, emailed her, couldn't get a response.
Yeah.
3 months of me trying to figure out a way to get in contact with Elaine Craig. Because in my head, I didn't know that she was that high up, that she was one of the top voice casting people and has been for a long time. I just thought, hey, here's this really nice lady who I met through my professor. She's from Illinois. I'm from Illinois. We went to the same university. She told me to do this. And so I got a hold of the professor and I went, Tom, I hate to do this, but here's what she said. and I could really, really use this right now, just to see where I was going.
Yeah.
And he placed one call. The next morning, she called me.
Amazing.
And apologized right away. She's like, I'm really sorry. Things have just been busy. I don't want you to think that this is a Hollywood thing, that the pejorative. Right. So how can I help you? And I told her what the situation was, and she went, okay, I have a couple. And she paused and went, no, I know the one person you need to meet. Here, call this number or email this thing and tell her that I sent you. And it was Nancy Wolfson over in Brentwood. And I was like, I went and met her as former agent. She could diagnose a problem. I remember working with her once. I'm in the booth in the whisper room that she had.
Yeah.
She's at her desk. She wasn't looking at me. She was on her computer answering emails, but she was listening.
Yeah.
And she went, while I was reading one, she said, get your hands out of your pockets. She knew I was slouching and that I had my hands in my pockets or my thumb around my belt loop, something. She knew it right away and went, she is so good.
She's so good.
So good. So I worked with her for a year, cut the demo.
Yeah.
A month later, I started booking.
Amazing.
And I thought, hey, is it going to be this easy forever? It wasn't.
No.
Very quickly, I wasn't booking. And this was all the stuff through her relationships, through an agency in San Francisco, or self-submitting on Voice123, Vox, Voice Jockeys, Craigslist, Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just every medium you could think of. I think LinkedIn came into it at one point.
Amazing.
And
just hustling.
Yeah, just thousands upon thousands upon thousands of auditions later. And I was working as a PA, as a teleprompter operator, as an office PA, as a finance PA, as a wardrobe PA, writing on random things here and there. Worked in music licensing out of the guy who wrote the Muppet Babies theme song's house.
Wow.
And then it was around, I was working for the UFC, and due to a nepotism situation, lost my gig where I was the teleprompter operator for the amazing John Anik, who I love to this day. And I knew I had 6 months left on my lease of my apartment. And at that point, I was fed up with a lot of things in the industry, a lot of the racism, a lot of the cronyism and nepotism.
Yeah.
And things were just so rough that I was looking around and I could not for the life of me catch a break. It was every single gig I was working was worse than the one that preceded it and barely getting by. I know the first 2-3 years I made less than 10 grand a year.
Oh my God, man.
And there were entire weeks I wouldn't eat for an entire week because I would go, well, I can't afford to do that and pay for the voice class. So I would just not eat, and then I would give her the money and I would do the class to try and get as many classes as I could in to speed it up. And it wasn't until I was talking to my oldest brother and he just heard how delirious I was on the phone.
Yeah.
And I let it slip. I was like, yeah, I do this sometimes. Next thing I knew, I got a call from my mom going, well, you know that there's this emergency credit card that we can all use if it's an emergency. It's like, you not eating is the definition of an emergency. This is just a bad idea. And both of my parents are doctors, so as the child of doctors and from a family that has doctors and professors and the like in it, like, where did you think this was a good idea? Like, I knew it wasn't a good idea, but at the time it was the only thing that I could see that made sense.
Yeah.
Because if I put that bill on them, it was just a further acknowledgement that this is not working out, which meant that there was going to be a phone call going, maybe you should come back or go back to this thing. And I was so hard-headed about it that I went, it's my fault that I'm here. It's my fault that I'm in the situation that I'm in. So I have to find a way out of it without inconveniencing anybody else.
Yeah.
And it took forever. Like, I was going to leave in 2013, in August 2013.
Wow.
And then I took the first gig that I could get off of Craigslist, and it was working at a celebrity gossip outfit, not TMZ, but a competitor of sorts to it, just uploading videos to YouTube.
Yeah.
The entire business of it I found repugnant, but there's also rent and things, and I just lost that gig with the UFC, which I went, well, now I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
Because rent is due, I got to take this gig. And I met some of the best people I've ever met in my life, but we all looked at it going, this is kind of like that truck stop way station.
Yes.
We're all here just waiting for someone to let us go.
Yeah.
And then while I was there, I went, well, if I'm going to move back to Chicago, might as well just start doing Second City here. I can get a jump on it when I'm back home.
Yeah.
And it was when I went to the Second City that I met the people who gave me the biggest reason to stay.
Wow.
Outside of the people I came with, because I could tell the people I came with, like, look, it just professionally isn't working out. I can do voiceover from anywhere.
Yeah.
Like, I could go home and do that.
Yeah.
And not have to deal with all this other nonsense. But, and I grew up watching The Second City, and being from Chicago, it looms so large in our minds and the people who came from it.
Yeah.
That when I went there, the first show that I saw, it had Sam Richardson, Frank Caietti, Ithamar Enriquez, and Brad Morris, all who I saw on the main stage of Chicago a year and a half earlier. I was like, wait, what? First class I had was with Ithamar. I went, hey, wait, what? And he convinced me to do the bingo show where, like, students go and put their name in the thing.
Yeah.
He kept telling me, you got to go do it. And I was so nervous, but I went. And, I mean, years of working in radio and just making a fool of myself anyway helped that a bit. But I did that. My name got called. I went up. And at the end of it, Sam turned to me and goes, what class are you in? And I just raised one finger and went, one? He goes, con one? He's like, no, improv one. He just leaned back and goes, you're going to be fine. And I went, whoa, okay, that's great. So around the third, it was really around the third class that when my oldest brother called, I went, I think I might need to stick around a little bit longer.
Yeah.
Because there might be something going on here. And all of those people that I met in that third class are some of the closest people in my life. And once I got into the conservatory, I met Sean George, who's my creative partner in all things. One of the only people who can convince me, you need to stop working right now. We're gonna go bowling, or we're gonna go to some underground wrestling thing. We're just gonna not work.
Yeah.
But he's also the guy who can creatively push me to do all kinds of things I didn't think we were able to do. And it was really that liberating thing of going to Second City and Ithamar saying on the first day, he's like, just empty your mind.
Hmm.
Don't go out there with anything. Just go out there and let it happen. And since then, I really just operate almost entirely in my life completely empty.
Yeah.
Just looking around going, yeah, anything could happen.
Yeah.
Let's just have some fun with it. Let's see where we go.
Oh, my God, dude. So
that was a long way of answering your question.
No, it was beautiful. What an extraordinary story. And, like, you know, the places, for me personally, where it intersects, and, like, the drive to stay, the drive to find your own way through it. That feeling of, my wife and I talk about it as like, from Pirates of the Caribbean, of burning the rum. Mm-hmm. You know, that realization where, when things are desolate, that idea of, like, I don't have another option. I really don't. All of my eggs are in the one basket that just got run over. So I've got to figure something out, and then doing it, you know. But then also, like, the Second City, Los Angeles, is an extraordinarily special place, and, like, it was the first place that we went to when we got here, that I went to, certainly, of, like, I went in and I recognized half the people I knew from Second City Detroit, and walked in like, hey, man, I need work. And Funk was like, great, here's class, here's conservatory, here's, like,
such a lovely man. I love Josh Funk. He's such a good guy.
Such a great guy. And like, it's the best friends that I've made outside of voiceover have come from, in particular, this location. I mean, it's a really special group of people, and I love it very much, and I'm
thrilled. It's an amazing thing that people who are part of the Second City LA, Second City Hollywood community, if they've ever been to a holiday party for it, they've heard this iconic speech by Josh Funk every year. And the first year you hear it, it hits you like a thunderbolt if you're really paying attention, like lightning bolt or the sound of thunder. It hits you and you go, wow, this man is saying something really, really moving. But the most important element of the speech that he gives is the one that most people gloss over, which is, this is your home. We'll always be there for you. We've always got your back.
Yeah.
So you can come home whenever you want.
Yeah.
The part that people forget is you can come home whenever you want, which implies that you need to leave. At some point, you got to get out of the comfort zone. You got to go someplace else. You got to try something new. We'll always be here, whether in a physical building or the community that you built. We'll always be there for you.
Yeah.
But you need to go try some things.
Yes.
And I remember one year I came back because I think I graduated in 2014. And while I was in the conservatory, they pulled me out of it. Ron West pulled me out while I was in the conservatory and put me in one of his shows.
Oh, wow.
Which was 60 blackouts in 60 minutes.
Oh, you did that show. Oh, my
yeah,
God.
Yeah, that was insane. And I was a swing understudy for Ace Gibson and Josh Bandet. And then before I knew it, I had to know all of George Kaliotis' lines and Steve Brewster's lines. I had to direct the show once for Ron when he had to go and work on the Chicago Shakespeare Festival that he usually is a part of.
Yeah.
So while I was in Con 1 or Con 2, he pulled me into that, and it was something unheard of that really had never happened before. And then by the time I did the Con show, I was already in three different premium shows, and
dude.
Sean George and I built a vaudeville duo doing an updated form of vaudeville where I was the narcissistic con man and he was my oaf. And the first show we did was a play within a play within a play about two guys named Sean and Rama trying to put on a two-man sketch show, but interrupting it to handle personal business with each other. But every way that we promoted the show, even down to the programs, was just, hey, Sean George and Rama Valuri are going to do a sketch show. And people we knew in the community wanted to see that, or
amazing.
Friends of ours wanted to see that. Well, these guys would work really well together. Let's see what this is. From the moment it started, from the start of the first fire call and the needle drop, we're fighting in silhouette backstage. And then we'd intro the show, and I wrote a sketch with Sean called The Penguin Joke. I set out to write the worst sketch of all time. And it was this framing device that we would keep coming back to the penguin joke. We would interrupt each other, do what was a sketch in our actual show, interrupting the show that didn't exist. And then we would come to an agreement after we resolved the thing of, should we start the show over? Yeah, let's just start the show over. And we'd call, the fire call would happen again, the needle drop would happen again. We'd come out to do the penguin sketch again. We'd get one line further, and then we would interrupt it again.
Oh,
something
amazing.
Else would come up. And there was a guy that I worked with at a different company who loves the theater, came from a theater background. He was so terrified 40 minutes into the show, he kept looking back down at the program and up, going, I don't know how they're going to do this. They haven't even gotten past the penguin joke. And it drove him nuts. And to this day, people will ask, well, what is the penguin joke? What was it? How did that sketch end? And the honest answer, which we told a couple people, was there is no end to that sketch. I went, why? It's like, we never wrote it, because no matter what we write, it would never be as good as what exists in your imagination.
That's
either
right.
Completely unsatisfactory, or it was too good for the sketch that happened.
Oh, that's
well,
so great.
They never got to see that. So Sean and I were doing that. Then the follow-up show we did was an hour-long investment seminar. So everyone who was there was there to invest in three of our bad ideas. One was material, one romantic, and one ecclesiastical. The three things throughout history that you always appeal to. There's always a market. So the first thing was vanity. It was a hairspray for women called Albino Stallion that gave you the get up and go you need, but it also had trace amounts of black tar heroin in it just to create dependence. Our second was a dating system called the Romantic System, which was 350 pickup lines with 100% proven success by me. And it was all just stuff that would never work, but we claimed that it did. And the third thing was we invented a religion called the United Congregation of Meism, where for a license fee of $1,000 a year, or really $999.99, because that's more appealing to people, you have the right to say, I believe in me. There's no book to buy. There's no services to go to, no buildings, no institution. But this is about you. You can make your own holidays. You can make your own things as long as you're a member of our congregation and you pay us. But if you don't, then we'll sue you. And I even wrote a stomp clap Pentecostal revival song.
Oh, my God, dude.
Called I Believe in Me with Max Butler, who was our MD. Sean,
yeah.
Sean grew up with him. And that man and I have this beautiful unspoken language when it comes to music. Since the lockdown started, we've formed two bands and have over 40 songs that I've written that are in various states.
Amazing.
One band is completely comedy.
Uh-huh.
King Oaf and the Quarantines, and King Oaf is in honor of Sean. But we've played everything from country to what we called industrial disco in a song about the state of Michigan. Yeah, there's been soul, there's been funk, there's Maxwell Street Blues.
Oh, man.
And then this was partly because of Joey Clift, the excellent L.A. comedian, native rights activist, expert on all things Japanese wrestling and independent wrestling, but also the biggest fan and enemy of Garfield the Cat.
Really?
He did this, I don't know why, but he did this thing where he said as a joke, while we're all in lockdown, let's finish the 50 States albums for Sufjan Stevens. So he just put the word out and asked all of his friends who are comedians and musicians, hey, do you want to do this? We'll go state by state. So you just pitch me a song about a state or a state, and we'll do that. And since we didn't have anything better to do, like I'm trapped in an apartment in Koreatown, Max is out in Northridge, we can't work. We went, well, we already write music together. Why don't we just actually just give ourselves a reason to have a deadline?
Oh, my God.
So the first song, Joey had asked, like, what do you want to write about? And I said, Butte, Montana. He's like, have you ever been? No. There's just something about it, and I'm sure it's lovely for the people who live there and grew up there and all. But for me, for some reason, I associated with if I ever woke up in Butte, Montana and looked around and went, this is my life now. I would end it just because I don't know how I got there, and I know that I'd never be able to leave. So I just wrote a country song called Butte, Montana, parentheses, I ain't going back.
And I sang it like this. Uh-huh. Like, there's a place out in the country, silver blue under a big sky.
And then Max and I just made a really great country song.
Amazing.
I was playing the guitar, the banjo, the mandolin, singing lead.
Dude.
And it was weird because it was so easy. And I've been a musician my whole life, playing in the orchestra and uh-huh. taught myself the guitar. And my brothers are both musicians.
Yeah.
But I never gave myself permission to do that.
Wow.
That was something that I just, even while I was at Second City, I went, well, I know I can sing. And I know I can play the guitar, but this is not my thing. Like, I'm friends with too many musicians who I respect. My brothers are both musicians, and they're better at it than me. So I'm not going to do that. And it wasn't really until I started working with Sean and directly Max that I went, well, wait, no, this is fun, and we can actually do this. And
you have permission to do it. And, like, there is this thing. I bought a drum machine. Earlier before lockdown,
mm-hmm.
and I bought it or a sequencer. I don't even know exactly what it is, but it's fun. And like, I had never given myself permission to do anything unless I was going to pursue it for real. You know what I mean? Like, it was then, and then people will ask you, "What are your hobbies?" And you go, "I'm a voice actor, but I make my living doing that. I do funny voices." You know, but like I find myself, staring at Jack Nicholson's typewriter in The Shining going, this is all I do aside from collect vinyl and play video games.
Well, that was a thing that I really thought about when I was on that grad trip from Syracuse. We met a famous screenwriter, really nice guy. And he went around the room and he asked what each person wanted to do. Like, what was your goal working in the industry? And when he got to me, I said, well, I'm a writer, but I also do audio work. And he just leaned back and went, you got to pick one thing. Pick one thing and be great at it.
Yeah.
And when he said that, I went, well, this makes a lot of sense, but I categorically disagree with it. And it wasn't to be contrarian about it.
Yeah.
But I found it so limiting to say this is the only thing that I do. And for most of my life, that was really the thing. It was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to be a history professor, so I'm going to do the things that let me do that and be better at that. And then all of a sudden I went to Paris and I wasn't anymore.
Yeah.
I was a much better historian and academic for doing it, and I still love it, and I still will read all those complicated articles from professors and those heavy books. But I couldn't do the publisher parish lifestyle of waking up in Ames, Iowa, for example, teaching during the day and then in the stacks at night.
Yeah.
It didn't click with me the same way that it did when I was going.
Yeah.
And I find that everything you allow yourself to do, that you give yourself permission to do, refills that creative tank. The danger is, and it's very hard in social media world being what it is, and the tendency for even the best of us or the worst of us to share just a little bit too much, or the feeling that you need to post things so that people know that you're there.
Yeah.
It's that cry for recognition of your existence in a way.
Yeah.
As close as we are, we're still very far apart, as the pandemic has showed us.
Absolutely.
But I remember the things that I would do for myself that weren't work, because everyone in my family is a workaholic, and we all have to find ways to not be on all the time. And friends of mine to this day will say still, you need to turn off. Mm-hmm. You need to do things that aren't. And I love reading, so I read a ton of books.
Yeah.
And I'll put an unrealistic number, like, oh, I'm going to read 100 books. Doesn't matter if it's a combination of nonfiction, fiction, graphic novels, audiobooks, anything. As long as I'm intentionally engaging with this medium, then great, I'm reading. And like you, I am a vinyl junkie.
Man.
And I have audiophile systems. Like, I know my favorite record stores in L.A. and Chicago, Milwaukee, New York, all this.
Yeah.
I can go get. Well, I love records.
I love it. And I can go get lost in the stack. And it's the place where I get outside of myself. It's a place where I project myself in between that hunt of finding the thing that you think you're missing.
Mm-hmm. I told people that if they, especially where I live now, because it's just me here in this townhouse that I was fortunate to get, there's a wall that I refer to as the wall of sound, because there are two giant record shelves stacked on top of each other with all the LPs and 45s. And then on either side are these two heavy bookcases. And they're all of them are organized in that high fidelity kind of way, that Nick Hornby way of explaining. There are ways that all of us organize our vinyl. And I haven't done it autobiographically, but I could tell you where I got every single one of those records and why.
Yep.
But I went, okay, so this starting here to here, it's alphabetical. Post 1955 popular music.
Right.
Doesn't matter the genres contained therein, but it's going alphabetical and chronological in order of release.
Yes.
And then it goes, okay, then I have all of these blues and jazz records. They're going together. Comedy records, albums that are international that defy conventional organization, and I don't want them to get lost.
Yes.
In some other things.
Yeah.
Soundtracks.
Oh.
And then if you look at the books, it's like, oh, novels are organized in one place, and then here are all books related to comedy and entertainment. Here are all science, political science, social history, all the heavy stuff that when I read people go, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
And there's art all over the place. But if you're over there, every room in my house, apart from my office where I work or where the TV is intentionally analog, where you have to disconnect.
Yeah.
Like, I'll leave my phone in the other room and just my dog and I will sit there listening to records while I'm reading books, because to continue to engage with it, I have to get up and flip it over.
Yes.
And I'm a completist, so I will listen front to back on all of them, even if it's a multi-LP thing, like Springsteen's Live 75 to 85. Like,
first one.
I will listen to every record on that
everyone
in order, and then go, okay, now that this is done, I'll go and do whatever.
From but Thunder Road like to No Surrender, man.
Yeah. I just need to not be in a position where I feel like I'm working, where I know that the books that I'm reading are, I'm learning from, and they're informing things that I'm going to do personally and professionally. The music I'm listening to, I love, but I'm listening to in a much deeper way than I did before.
Yeah.
Where the liner notes are even more important than when I was a kid going, hey, this is really cool.
Yeah.
Now I'm listening to so much that I'm going, oh, this is a really interesting way to play. This is a nice change here. Why did you write it in this key?
Yeah.
And as someone who's writing music, I just keep consuming more and then asking, well, can I write in that genre? And that's a fun challenge Max and I have, where we don't limit ourselves going, well, we have to be this one type of band.
Yeah.
We can write whatever, as long as the songwriting is good, which I'm the one who's writing the lyrics. And usually how it works is I'll get some idea, whether it's the lyrics or I'll map out a demo and as many instruments as I feel necessary, and I'll work through it. By the time I get to Max, I'm like, these lyrics are going to be there. This is what it's going to be. How we're forming it, it is in this key. Here's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
And then we we haven't been able to write together in person at all since we were doing shows at Second City.
Man.
So it's so tricky on the phone or text message or email chains going, here's what I'm thinking. Here's an artist or a song or a vibe that I'm thinking. And then he'll say, but I'm hearing this.
Wow.
And then we just go back and forth and go, well, why don't we do this? So it could shift six different genres by the time we get there. But our rule is musically, it has to be tight.
Yeah.
And he, as a professional musician who's connected to all these amazing session musicians, has a standard in his head of we have to be that good to get these people to play on it and want to play on it. And for me, when I'm writing the comedy ones, I go, okay, the Flight of the Conchords, Eric Idle kind of mentality kicks in where, yes, the songs are really funny when you're listening to them and thinking of them as complete pieces, but I want you to be confused when you're listening to it going, this is just a really good song.
Yeah.
And
if you listen closely, that's right.
You'll want to listen more and you'll find new things. And that was the thing. It's like giving yourself permission. I know, like, I love to draw, but when I was at a job that was stressing me out, like, I tell people, honestly, I cannot look at pictures of myself between the age of 23 and 30, really, 30 to 31, because I was working all these jobs that I hated, sleeping less than 4 hours a night every night. There were entire stretches where I couldn't eat, or I would go to the job all day, then I would be in 3.5 hours of classes at Second City, and then because I lived on the west side, I didn't want to get stuck in traffic, so I'd watch every show that night and likely do them, to the point that I was at Second City 7 days a week. And if you're at Second City 7 days a week, you're at Bordner's 7 days a week.
That's right.
So once you're friends with people who are there drinking, or you're friends with the bartenders, suddenly things are heavier, pours, then you start engaging and you're like, this is my cheers. This is what I grew up wanting. I wanted a vibe like that.
Yeah.
And then you drink yourself in competition with everybody just because you happen to be there.
Right.
And it's one of those beautiful and terrible things about any comedy community school. And I know it was true for people at UCB and IO.
Certainly.
Was when I started, everybody was so territorial about, well, I'm at Second City, so I don't hang out with people at UCB.
Yeah.
Or we're at Second City, so we don't hang out with people at IO or Groundlings, God forbid.
Right.
Really quickly, you realize, oh, we all are the same. We all love comedy. It's just the method that appeals to us more.
Yeah, and the end result being, you know, the way, I mean, I'm sure you've dealt with this in the classes where someone is like, well, what's the difference between da 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 da? And then you're like, well, we do, you know, we write. That's the goal, is to improv, to write, and all those things. And you're right, like that territorial aspect of all the different schools. But then you go to a commercial audition and you're staring at everybody from those same spaces. Mm-hmm. Or if people gets ostracized from one of those communities and finds himself in another one, you know what I mean?
Yeah. There are people who will give up where they were before and accept where they are now. Like, I know when I was at Second City, I ended up on a house team at IO without ever taking a class there. All because I went because someone had asked me to guest on their team, which is one of the bigger teams. And the month that I was going there, James Grace, prior to his ouster, went, well, he can't just do this show because we're doing auditions this month. Have him come and do auditions. And I went. It turns out I was friends with 8 out of 10 of the directors there anyway.
Yeah, right.
And then I got put on a team with a director I didn't know. I thought, I was going to be with Jesse Klein or someone that I'm pals with.
Jesse.
And instead, they put me on a new team that didn't exist. And the director was Jay Succo, who had just arrived from Chicago.
Oh, man.
And I'm thinking, all right, I'll go and do this. Jay is one of the most important people in my life now.
Wow.
He is an amazing person. And when he came, because he liked the way that I thought, and that we're both from Chicago and in that Chicagoland area.
Yeah.
So references he could make about old comedy, I would get, because we watched the same things on WTTW, the PBS station.
Right.
And he was so bothered by the fact that I only auditioned as a performer and not as a writer. And the rule was, okay, if you didn't audition as a writer, you're not going to write. You're just going to perform.
Oh, man.
But he liked how my brain worked. He was like, why won't they let you write for me? I went, well, that was my fault because I'm doing too much at Second City. And I wanted to keep all of the really good stuff in my head for the George and Valuri projects.
Man.
And he came and he saw one of the George and Valuri shows. And he walked up to Sean and I at the end and went, that was amazing, because the trust that Sean and I have from each other, and he could see how every move was calculated and how we complimented each other and just how smart the writing was.
So
that he said, he was like, well, I would joke with him, well, I'm thinking about taking a class somewhere. After I had left Second City in 2016, he's like, yeah, I'm thinking about taking a class. He goes, why? Why would you do that?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I feel like I'm not as active in the community or something. You're doing a show every night in some other theater, like Lyric Hyperion or Three Clubs or something, that the only reason you go to these schools is to learn from specific faculty to help define your comedic voice. He goes, yeah. What you and Sean do is so well-defined individually and collectively. Why would you want to mess with that?
Yeah.
That's fair. That's fair. He saved me a lot of money. And that, and then Sean and I spent it on making other things, like a movie that
that's
is
amazing.
A feature that is in post.
That's incredible. How did you? I want to backtrack a touch. You're working with Nancy. You get your reel. How do you? I came to town represented. How did you go about the business of coming here without a reel and representation and make the transition into a place where you're getting submitted for auditions? You don't have to self-submit for things. Mm-hmm. What's that process like?
Oh, that was pure chaos. There was an agency in San Francisco that I was able to work with on an informal agreement, and they would send auditions, and I would do those and think, okay, these are great. They were all non-union because I wasn't part of the union.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, it was the arrogance of youth and having gone through Nancy Wolfson's program, which is very, very difficult.
Yes.
Especially in a one-on-one thing. She's so amazing that you just are working constantly. You're always listening to commercials and going, okay, what is it that she's hearing that I'm not?
Yeah.
And how is she splitting it on the page? And if you looked at old auditions I did, if you look at the sides, every line is diagrammed in a way where I go, okay, I know I'm going to inflect up here. I'm going to go down here. This is where I'm going to breathe. This is a point of double emphasis. Oh, this is a referencer spot. It's not an expositor spot. This is what we need to do. This is what I'm seeing on TV. And I got so analytical about it that it became work, and I was losing the joy because I kept looking at it as the next gig that I book has to be the one that can take me out of working in offices. Like I can't do this anymore because every part of me in an office dies, and there's a natural rebellion in me when especially if I spot someone who, for better or worse, their management style, I go, this is not conducive to what we do. So I find ways to get everything done my way, which may not be their way, which isn't, I don't want to be in meetings. I don't want to be in meetings talking about what we're going to do. I'd rather do what we're going to do.
Yes.
What can be an email should be an email. What should be a meeting really has to be a meeting. Otherwise, we're just wasting our time.
Yes.
And I would be honest with everybody where I was working. I was like, I'm a comedian and voice actor, and this is what I do, and I'm going to go leave to do auditions. And fortunately, when I would say that, I had a national for Gillette that was on TV with me in it, and I was the voice of a drink for Starbucks. So there were some spots that they could go, oh, wait, no, he really does do this. And then they would go to Second City and go, oh, wait, no, that is what he does.
Yeah.
He just happens to be here. So I'd keep reinforcing that.
Yeah.
But
that's so helpful.
I would go from all the terrible jobs, I could be there, and then I would get an email from the algorithm at Voice123 or something going, hey, here's an audition. You need to get it done by 10 o'clock tonight. It's 6 o'clock in LA. I just got off work. Now I got to drive back to Culver City to get this spot in before 10 and then come back to Hollywood because I'm in a show that night.
Yeah.
So I would be driving across the city.
Oh, my God.
Or finding a quiet place in the office, trying to record as best I can.
Which is impossible. Which is freaking impossible.
It's
impossible. There's not a single place. I had to do a voice match job while teaching a class. And I had my students, I was like, look, this is a voiceover class. You want to see it happen for real? This is me doing Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
So we tipped over a table, and then someone had a hoodie, and we put it over top of it, and it was madness. There's no quiet place.
When I teach them, because they'll get really self-conscious about where they are in their journey. If they're just starting out, maybe they've been in it a little bit longer, and they get focused on the gear, and do I need to build a booth? Do I need to get a whisper room? Do I need to buy panels? What do I need to do? Said, if you got a closet with clothes in it and a good comforter, you're better off than 80% of us.
That's right.
And I would tell them, like, I've recorded in leaky basements, in offices, in storage rooms, in stairwells, in my car, under beds, in hotel rooms, in bathrooms. with people yelling. Yeah. And I did 2 audiobooks for Audible, and I was living in Culver City in that Fox Hills area between Ladera Heights and Westchester and everything, right by the LAX flyover.
Oh, my God.
I had to get up at 5 a.m. to record these books so I wouldn't wake up my roommates, get like 5 hours of recording done, then go to work for the whole day, come back, maybe get 30 minutes where I wasn't working on something, and then I'd go back and I have to go and edit what I did that morning, knowing the next morning I was doing more.
Oh, my God.
And that was kind of the pattern of I would go on Craigslist every day. I would go on all those sites every day. I'd constantly update. If someone asked me for a favor who was in the improv community going, hey, we shot this sketch. Can you do this voice for it? Without question, I would do it.
Yeah.
But everything is actual proof of what I'm doing. And it isn't just here are some spots that Nancy gave me to do for the audition.
Right.
Here's the actual practical thing.
Yeah.
And if they were friends of mine, I would never ask for money. If it was a friend of mine who was getting money to give to me, when I started, I was like, $20, because I wanted them to keep being able to give me money.
Yeah.
When I was at that celebrity gossip thing, their show was called Holly Scoop, and they made me the voice for it for their TV, doing the teases. And I was getting like $10 an hour or less as an employee. God. And when they asked me, well, you do this, how much to do the VO for it, I said $100 an episode, and I'll record all of it, deliver it, and you don't have to worry about it. But if it takes more than 2 re-records, then it's like another $35. And I was so nervous when I said it, and they went, okay. And I would go, wow, this is great. I'm going from one of the lowest spots in this place to all of a sudden, hey, IMDb, here's a credit that is actually somewhat useful, even though it was celebrity gossip. I think the 2 moments stick out to me as most definitive of my time there, and all props to them for putting up with someone like me who's a prankster, and I cannot focus on any of it, and I wish them nothing but the best. But there was one instance where they said, hey, here's a last minute story that's got to be on air. You need to go record the tease. So I go across the hall to record it, and I don't look at it. It just gets popped into the prompter.
Yeah.
I'm mic'd up with just a lav, and I go, does Selena Gomez have a new career, or does she have lupus? And I paused and went, oh Christ, this is what we're doing. This is what I am a part of.
Oh,
and
man.
I hated it so much because I also knew that would get people to stay.
Yeah.
Going into a break. I went, this is terrible. I don't like this at all. Fortunately, I didn't last there too much longer. I left. And the other, they gave me a lot of chances to be like, okay, we'll let you do some other things while you're building these platforms and dealing with legal cases and all. But clearly you're not happy, but we need to keep you because we don't have another option. So they would let me write, and I would write these sports stories and all. I was working late one night, and it was the night that Robin Williams passed.
Oh,
I was the only writer there, and they made me write the obit. And
oh, man.
I remember a suggestion that was like they needed a clickbait title or something, and I turned around and said, all you're getting from me is what's in the coroner's report. You can do whatever you want tomorrow, but you don't know how big a deal this is for someone like me.
Yeah.
And I hated myself. And all I did was really just transcribe what was in that report. And I went, no matter how bad it is financially, I need to get out of here.
Yeah.
And I decided, it was like, I'm going to apply for all these different gigs, but if I get one, great. If not, screw it. I'm just going to commit to doing VO.
Yeah.
And another company hired me, and I went, great. I told them this is what I do, and they accepted it. And I told myself then, that was really when I was working at this place, I went, I gotta book something. I gotta book something big enough that gets me out of here.
Yeah.
Because I can't keep doing this office stuff. It's killing me. Because I could see physically I was tired all of the time. I was just snacking on things for the sake of having something to do. You'd go out to lunch just to get out of that office.
Yeah.
And then because I was at Second City all the time, I was just living on whiskey. And you could see it. Like, between where I am now and then, at the height of it, I was 50 pounds heavier and miserable in every ounce of it.
Man.
And a lot of it was just tied to you're mortgaging so much of yourself.
Yeah.
And a paycheck is an addiction. It really is, once you get to a point where you're not even making that much, but you can rely on the fact that at the end of the month, this much is going to be in here and I can pay all of these bills and I don't have to worry for that month.
Yeah.
So you get so caught up in that that you lose parts of yourself. And then if you're giving the rest of yourself to another community, where I went from 10 hours at work to 10 hours hanging out at the Second City, where whether you're doing a show, watching a show, taking a class, or hanging out in that bar, you are on. Like everybody's running bits. You're trying to find who you want to work with, who you vibe with. You think this is the nature of it. It can get very toxic, as we've seen, where the jokes go from about people in power or silly situations that can become very personal and very petty.
Yeah.
And in the moment when people are saying something, even though they don't intend to hurt somebody, they do. And you're taught as a comedian, whether it's a stand-up, an improviser, sketch, or anything, you got to get a tough skin.
Right.
This is what it's like. But it doesn't have to be.
No.
And now people, from what I understand in a lot of these things, particularly over the last few years, empathy is so much more important than the bit. It's like really just, you're here because you're funny. Yeah. Or you're here because you see the world in a unique way. But understand everybody else with you does too.
Yeah.
And don't ridicule it. Like you should be punching up at the powerful. That's the privilege of their position. Don't punch down, and you don't need to punch left or right.
Right.
You don't need to have this image. And it's that repeat of high school where everybody's desperately trying to go like, well, I'm that guy.
Yeah.
I'm the physical comedian. I'm the one who does the sniper jokes. I go blue. I do this. I do that.
Right.
And I'm as guilty as anybody for not knowing. Like, well, I don't know what value I have. Am I the snarky guy? Am I this guy? Am I that guy?
Right.
And extricating myself from all of it was great, where I could go, okay, well, I'm only going to do the shows that I want to do and work with the people that I want to work with, and I just root for everybody and not be envious of what their situation is, because I know how bad it is when you're working 18, 19 hours a day and then fighting your way through traffic to do a one-line audition that you likely will never hear from again. And that's the thing I remind anyone who does VO work, because the biggest lie about what we do is this, and I'm sure you've heard it. You should do voiceover. I hear that's a great way to make extra money. I don't know who started that rumor. I don't know who put it out there. But it's the biggest misconception.
Agreed.
And I tell people, like, you have a voice, and that's a beautiful thing. Everybody's got their own unique voice, their own unique instrument.
Yeah.
As an impressionist, yes, I can do a lot of them.
Yes.
But it's never going to be exactly that person.
Right.
So the first step is acknowledging that this is what you want to do and giving yourself the permission to do that.
Yeah.
The next is the recognition that this is not easy. It's not an easy way to make money. There are a lot of people doing it.
Yeah.
And you have to be very comfortable with a special type of rejection. Where if you're auditioning in person for an on-camera gig or a theater piece or a sketch show or something, there are people in the room. There's an energy you can play off of. You can try new things. In this, you are literally screaming into the void and hoping that they listen. And casting directors or ad agencies, when they're listening to these spots, they know 8 seconds in or less whether they're going to keep going. It could be how you said your name on your slate. And they go, no, that's not our guy. It's very passive, and it's going through assistance before it's getting to people. And you have to learn not to take it personally, even though it is personal.
Yes.
They are rejecting you. They are rejecting your voice because that is what you are selling.
Yeah.
And it just because yours isn't the right thing for what they're looking for.
Right.
So while it's personal, it also absolutely isn't.
Yes.
So when students ask me, how many auditions have you done? I went, I don't know, 10,000 is low, I feel like, for this point of my life between working in radio and now. And I tell them, I forget about the audition right after I'm done with it.
You have
to do it. I send it off. And then if I'm fortunate enough that a couple days or weeks, or in the case of animation and video games, months later, I hear back about it. I go, oh, yeah, I vaguely remember that. And I have to go back and find the recording and go, oh, yeah, all right.
Hey, that was good. I liked what I did there. Yeah. I can understand why they called me back for that. That's great.
It's a nice thing now, though, that I don't mark up scripts, and I don't go through and try and plan out here's where I'm going to breathe or anything, because I've worked at this so long. This is almost 15 years of it for me, that I know in the moment that I can do it.
Yes.
And being when I was rep by WME, that was a big thing, because you'd have to go in to record commercials. They didn't send it to you unless you absolutely requested it, because they didn't like confidential copy being out. So you'd have to go there and record in their booths with their engineers. And I got to know so many amazing voice actors that way at the legendary lobby of William Morris Endeavor.
Amazing.
Especially on days when the computers and network would crash and then you're there for 4 or 5
just
hours.
There.
But I knew it was like, okay, well, I'm here. I arrived. I'm at the biggest agency in the world, so I must be doing something right. But I would analyze every time I went in. And fortunately, I became friends with all of the booth directors.
That's
and they
huge.
Were always very straight with me.
That's so great.
They were my people. I was always an engineer. And they would always tell me, he's like, trust your instincts. Your instincts are right. We're going to refine them a little bit. And the volume that I was recording and operating at, I went, yeah, I should be here. I should be doing this. And I can trust that everything I send in is the best that I can do right now.
Yep.
And that I'm happy to have my name on it.
Yeah.
And I could say years ago that wasn't the case, where I could do an audition at 8 in the morning and I wouldn't send it in because it wasn't due till 9 that night. And I would run it through my head going, I could do this better. And I would have it on my phone or in the car or on the computer and be like, no, I could do this better.
Yeah.
I could do this better. And I'd freak myself out about it. And I do this because I love it. Someone asked me if you could do anything, where are you happiest in a work setting? I said, in that booth.
In that booth.
Stick me in a booth with a microphone in front of me.
Oh, man.
The directors, engineers, whatever, and just let us play.
Yeah.
Just let us play, and I'm really happy there. And as much as I love live performance and doing musicals and plays and all of that, I think of the marketing side of it, especially in a town like L.A., which is not a theater town.
Right.
Like Chicago or Vancouver, Toronto, New York, obviously, London. Yeah. There's a lot of work to convince somebody to go. And the traditional wisdom in Los Angeles is you invite 100 people, expect a response from 30, and if you're lucky, 12 will show up.
Yeah.
And we were fortunate that when Sean and I were really going as George and Valuri, we sold out every show that we did.
Man.
But we haven't done a live show since 2016, and partly because we went, well, we've done that.
Yeah.
We know how to do that. We know that we can do that. Let's do something else.
Yeah.
So we made a movie, because that was one thing. We hadn't made a feature, and now we did, and no one can tell us that we didn't.
Amazing.
So
that's so great.
It's just really, it's tricky, because when I got here, I did not identify as an actor. And even to this day, there are moments where I go, I'm not an actor. I'm a guy who does funny voices. I know too many people who are, well, I went to Tisch. I went to this. I went to that. I'm at the actor's studio. And I will at times go, well, they've done all this stuff. I'm just a comedian from the Second City. And it's really easy to shortchange yourself that way. But when I first got here, I was like, I'm not an actor. I'm a voice guy. I'm a voice guy who just is sneaking through the system. I would say there's always a loophole to something I'm doing. I'm exploiting the system, because it was a very revolutionary thought in my head. But it was when I was at Nancy, she asked, he's like, do you do comedy? He's like, no. Like, I write it. I write sketch, but I never act in them. And she went, you should go to improv. You should go to the Second City. I was like, well, if I'm going to go to one, it's going to be the Second City.
Yeah, right.
Where I'm from, and I've gravitated to that more than I owe.
Amazing.
But I went, well, I can only afford to pay one of you. I could either pay you or I could pay them. What do you want me to do? She says, pay me. I was like, great. I admire how
Dude,
honest you are about it.
And but how great, said, like, the best advice, too, because like spending the money with Nancy and getting it done, Second, you can work through. The Second City is workable. And, you know, as you know, and have been through it and freaking taught. So like, you know, but I'm glad that that's the path that you chose to do.
Right. And the thing with someone like Nancy, it's similar to if you didn't sign up for Bob Bergen's class 10 years ago, you're likely never going to get to take it because
right.
the wait list is so long.
Right.
And Nancy, if you didn't have an appointment on the books, you'd have to hope and pray that someone would cancel,
yep.
that you could take their slot.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make sure that I was always there for the ones that I was scheduled for.
Yes.
And that if something came up, I could drop everything and go.
Yes.
And I once walked from Fox Hills to Brentwood and back.
Oh, my God.
Because my car broke down the day before. And I went, well, I got to go.
Got to go.
And because I had nothing better to do, it's one of these dumb challenges I give myself. I put exact bus fare one way in my pocket with the check for her and had headphones and my phone loaded up with episodes of Mark Maron's WTF podcast. And I went, well, I'm going to get back. I have to get back. And I walked the whole way back from Brentwood.
Amazing.
And as I'm walking up this really tall hill and to get back to my place, I get a call saying, hey, your car's ready. And I went, okay. It was 5 miles further because it was over in Westchester.
Man.
So I just walked. I went, well, I've gone this far. I might as well just go. So I just kept walking. It was so, so dumb.
Oh, man.
And I intentionally, like somewhere halfway, I walked into, I think it was a Whole Foods, and I bought a bottle of water. So I didn't even have the bus fare anymore.
Oh, man.
And it was fine. I was like, well, this is good. I got to listen. The John Hamm podcast,
oh,
I remembered
man.
Being very good on that.
Terrific.
On that walk.
I need to
but
listen to that.
That's the thing.
One.
Like, I didn't have the acting background, and I didn't trust myself enough to say that I was an actor. I was always a fraud. It was like, oh, yeah, I'm a voice guy pretending to be a comedian at the Second City. And the next thing I know, I was in all of these shows.
All right, so that's the first half of our conversation. No need to wait. The second episode of my two-parter with Rama Valluri is available right now. Peace. This has been All Over VoiceOver with Kiff VH. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please go to iTunes and give us a positive rating. It truly helps. Follow me on Twitter at Kiff VH or on Instagram at Kiff VH or on Vero at Kiff VH. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you soon. Claim victory and depart the field.
Werewolf?
Yeah.